All right, let's go ahead and turn to Genesis 1. I'm going to just kind of recap a little bit of what we looked at the last couple weeks. We spent a lot of time just looking at the first couple verses of Genesis chapter 1. Probably way more time than you thought we were going to spend on those two verses, but it is pivotal to think about what they're saying and the relationship between the two, and then how the rest of Genesis 1 kind of follows from the beginning situation that's introduced to us in the first two verses. So we notice, first of all, that there is a very clear structure to Genesis chapter 1. We have a statement, an overarching statement about what God is going to do in Genesis 1, that He is going to create the heavens and the earth. We see how that statement at the beginning of chapter 2 is repeated again, basically saying that God did what He said He was going to do, and He did so in a very orderly fashion. First of all, verse 2 points out that the land was formless and void, that it was uninhabitable for human beings. And God worked day after day, progressively, to make and to form and to fill His creation and to make it suitable for human beings. So God is taking an uninhabitable place that is dark, that is full of an abyss, and He's making it suitable for us. So God is demonstrating for us, through the orderly account and through the patterns that we see in Genesis 1, how God brings these things into existence, how He creates and He forms them with His Word, how He separates and names the things that He's created, giving them a purpose, giving them a function, a reason for existing, and a role that they're going to have within the creation. Now, what we're going to do today is actually look at the last 2 days, basically, of the creation account. And I know that we haven't answered every single question that you have about Genesis 1, and we're probably not going to. There's just so much that we can get into. There's so much that we can talk about in this passage. But we're going to try to focus in on what we think is the most important part about the creation account. And that's God's creation of man and God's rest, His blessing, and His sanctification of the seventh day. So that is the climax of the creation account, is God's creation of mankind. The culmination, the whole purpose for the creation account then, is the seventh day in which God rests from His creation, His creative work. Okay, so that's kind of why we're going to focus on that. There's so much here, even in these 2 days, that we're not going to be able to answer every single question that you may have about it. But we at least want to focus in on what Genesis 1 is showing us as the most important thing about creation. So we're going to read the entire account, beginning in verse 1, all the way through the first 3 verses of chapter 2. We haven't actually done this in the last 2 weeks, and my apologies for that, but we're at least going to do that today. And all I want you to do is simply just reflect upon and think about the repetitive nature, the rhythmic pattern of the creation account in Genesis 1. So let's do that. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness He called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning the second day. And God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit, in which is their seed, each according to its kind, on the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit, in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, let there be light in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. And let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures, and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to their kind, to its kind. And God saw that it was good, and God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruits. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. All right, so like I said, we're going to be focusing in on day 6 and day 7, referring a little bit back to the previous days when it comes up in the context. Day 6, you'll note that day 6 is a very busy day. So if you simply go through and you just kind of count the verses of day 6, you'll see that they make up like a 25% of the other 6 days of creation. So here on day 6, we have a lot of things happening on day 6. We have the creation of the living creatures, the livestock, the creeping things, the creepy crawlers, the beasts of the earth. Day 6, all of those land creatures are formed and created. And then, of course, we have God's creation. There's a slight pause, maybe a slight hesitation. He's stalling out, focusing in on God's creation of man, which takes more time and sheds more light upon the uniqueness of mankind compared to the other things that God has made. And we see at the end, we see God's provision for the beast that he's made and for the man that he's made. God has provided the seed-bearing plants that bring forth fruits, producing after their own kinds for man to eat, and the trees bringing forth fruit for mankind to eat as well. So God creates and he provides for his creation with those things that he's made out of the land on day three. He declares now that they serve the purpose of creating food as they reproduce by their own seed for the beast and the man that God has made. So, let's look a little bit more in detail about the sixth day. This is clearly the climax of creation. So, if we think about why God took 6 days, he could have done it all in one instant, but he does so in a very rhythmic pattern. He's creating a pattern for the world. Just fascinating, as Amber and I talked about this past week, that it's still amazing to us that our weeks, our lives are built around 7-day weeks. I know there's probably been other cultures that have done different lengths of weeks, but here we are, patterning our lives, building our lives around a period of 7 days. Still somewhat fascinating that we still do that. That there hasn't been any attempts, universally speaking, to kind of overrule the pattern that God has used to create the world in such a way. But the period of 5 days has been building to this moment. God is taking the formless and void creation. He's been separating, naming, forming, making, gathering, and causing things to come forth so that day six can happen. So that the land that God has made can now be inhabited and God can put his people on that land. So this is clearly the pattern of creation God has been building toward. This is the climax of the creation accounts. This is what the Spirit of God was intending when he was sitting there over the darkness, over the abyss, hovering over the waters, building in anticipation of what was going to happen. What does it actually look like? What was the end goal of that energizing Spirit there waiting to breathe upon and to breathe into new life? What was he waiting to do? He was waiting to create man. Now we see how his plan of coming and bringing creation about comes to its fullness. But the day six begins with God creating the land creatures. So verse 24 tells us what these creatures are. Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds. Livestock, creeping things, beasts of the earth, according to their kinds. And it was so. So what we see happening in the previous 5 days when God creates specific things in his creation, his words do what he sends them out to do. He says, let the earth bring forth these creatures, similar to what he said on day three when he says, let the land bring forth vegetation. Now the land is bringing forth creatures. God speaks and the creatures come about. Well, verse 25 follows verse 24 in a similar pattern to the other 5 days of creation by stating that God made all these creatures according to their kinds. So God creates the land creatures and he concludes, he evaluates his creation with the pattern that we saw in the previous days by seeing that God saw that what he created was good. So again, God is showing forth his creative power. What his words accomplish, what he set forth for them to accomplish, and what they accomplish is good. His assessment of his creation is that it is good. It is right. This is a solution to the problem then of verse 2. God is creating something good out of the chaos in an orderly fashion. Now, if you were paying attention, what you should expect after that pronouncement of goodness upon the land creatures would be what? Well, the way in which the other previous 5 days concluded. With the refrain, there was evening, there was morning, the first day, or the second day, or the third day, the fourth day, the fifth day. So God speaks, let there be, there is. God made those things. It was good. He assessed it. It was so. It was good. And then what happens? The day ends. There was evening. There was morning. That day is over. But that's not what we get in this account. That's different than what we see happening in the rest of those days of creation. There's actually a break in the pattern. The expectation that we would have is that that day would be done, that God's creative work would be finished. Yet God has one more thing to create on that day. So immediately then, in the context and the flow of Genesis 1, we see that this division between 25 and 26 causes us to pause and to reflect upon and to focus in on, to zoom in on what God is going to do next. You notice the ESV has, the repetition kind of reinforced by how it begins each day. It begins each day by saying, and God said such and such. But then you get to verse 6, and what is it, or 26, and what does it say? Then God said. So God is continuing His creative work, and it's being marked out for us as something unique. It's breaking from the pattern, and it causes us to focus in on what He creates next. He's highlighting, he's putting, you know, exclamation marks around these words saying, look now at what God has done. Look now at what He's created. So God creates something more. So the rhythmic flow, the pattern of the days of creation now reaches its climax, and God's creative work climaxes in His creation of man, of Adam, which becomes the proper name of the first man later on in the text. So man, as Herman Bovink has said, man is the purpose and end, the head and the crown of the whole work of creation. So we can now zoom in on this account, take notice of how the creation of man stands out from the rest of the creation accounts. How does He do so? How does this kind of jump off the page to us and help us to see the uniqueness of man as God has created him? So notice first, we see a description of God's plan to create. Now if you go back and you read the other accounts on the other days, what do you see? You see the statement saying, let there be something, or let the earth bring forth something. God is simply declaring something to happen, and His words accomplish that purpose. But God's creation of man doesn't begin, He doesn't begin His account of the creation of man with that divine fiat, that divine speaking of something into existence. He doesn't say, let there be man, in other words. That would be what we would expect to happen. But He doesn't say, let there be man. In fact, we actually get a little bit of a glimpse into God's own self-reflection or divine deliberation. He tells us what He's thinking before He actually does it, which is unique in the creation account. So He tells us His plan to make man. So God says, let us make man. So we get a glimpse then into God's mind. This is God speaking to Himself about what He is going to do next. God is planning to make man. He's declaring His plan to make man prior to actually making him. So this shows us that the creation of man is different than the rest of God's creation. It helps us to see that God's creation of man stands out. Now, notice as well that God's plan is to make man after a specific pattern. So He plans to make man after a specific pattern. What is the pattern? The pattern is God Himself. Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. So God now is following, or He's sharing with us his desire to make man after a pattern. There's a mold that God is using to create man. He's creating him after himself. God is using himself as the pattern to conform man to. Now, nowhere else does God say that he creates something by following a pattern. This is unique in the creation account. It makes the creation of man set apart and unique and different from the rest of God's creation. Now we see and hear from God's own voice that he's going to follow a pattern. The pattern in which he creates man is his very being. Now we'll get to the image and likeness later, but let's continue just to point out the different aspects in which this stands out in the creation account. Third, God has a purpose for the man that he creates. Man is given a purpose. Man is given dominion over the other creatures God has made. Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish, the birds, the livestock, the land, the creeping things that creep on the earth. So God has given to man a unique purpose. God is creating man to have dominion. Later on in the next 28, he says that they are to subdue the earth. Both of these terms refer to, in one way, to putting down opposition. So these are ruling terms. God is creating mankind as rulers over the other creatures that he's made and over the land that he's formed. Mankind is set up then as rulers over God's creation. So we see something similar happening in this passage as well with the idea of blessedness. So we see the uniqueness of God's blessing upon his creatures. It only happens three times in the text. Three times in Genesis 1 and beginning of chapter 2 in which God blesses his creatures. The last time we saw it is that in day 5. When God creates the birds, the flying creatures, and the swarming creatures in the seas, he blesses them and he tells them to fill the spheres in which they are placed. So the birds are to reproduce, they are to fill the skies, the swarming creatures are to reproduce, and they are to fill the seas. God blesses those creatures and wants them to multiply and to fill the places in which God has put them. That same blessing is bestowed upon the man. Man also is blessed with fruitfulness to fill the land, to have dominion over it and to subdue it, to use it for their purposes. So there is the similarity then between the responsibility for the swarming creatures, or the blessing bestowed upon the swarming creatures to fill the land, or to fill the seas and to fill the skies, and then also for the man to fill the realm or the sphere over which they've been put. There's also a similarity between the role in which the lights have in ruling over the day and the night. So God has put the sun and the moon in the sky in the firmament. He's placed them there and they are to rule over the day and the night. So God has formed and created rulers and placed them up in the sky to govern the day and the night. They are to order God's created realm. So there are similarities between man's responsibility and his honor and being bestowed upon him for dominion and to take dominion between the other created things. But this is unique in that man rules over everything that God makes. The sun and the moon rule over the day and the night, those things that they control, but mankind rules over all the rest of God's creation. Mankind rules over the realm in which they've been placed. They rule over the animals of the sky realm, they rule over the animals on the land, and they rule over the animals in the seas. They've been given that responsibility to have dominion over what God has created. So God has this clear plan then for man. He's followed the pattern of himself. He has a purpose for man that makes man stand out from the rest of his creation. There's a couple more things here I want to think about before we get to the image of God. Notice one thing. This is just kind of an observation. When man, you'll see when God creates the vegetation and the swarming things and the flying things and the beasts, you'll see that they are to reproduce according to their kinds. So that stands out as a pattern repeated all the way throughout the creation account, except for the account of mankind. There's nothing about the account of mankind or contained within the account of mankind where they are to reproduce according to their kind. So that stands out as a difference between how God has created other things. And we have to ask the question, well, why doesn't it include any sort of hint or note about them reproducing according to their kinds? So this is kind of interesting to think about, at least kind of conceptually. Why is it that mankind is not told to reproduce, or God says that they are to reproduce according to their kinds? They clearly are told to reproduce because they are to be fruitful, multiply, and to fill the land. They are to spread their seed, their offspring, over the realm in which God has given them dominion. They are to fill it and to subdue it by reproducing. But they don't reproduce according to their kind. At least that's not what we should think about when they reproduce. So what should we think about them reproducing? I think this is unique. We have a passage in Genesis 5 where the beginning of Genesis 5 reflects back upon Genesis 1 and God's creation of man, formed in the likeness of God, after the likeness of God. And what does man do? Well, man, Adam, in that sense, he has a son. And his son is made in his likeness, in his image. So Adam reproduces a son in his own likeness and image. That idea then shows us that the two terms, likeness and image, are interchangeable. They basically are synonymous. They mean basically the same thing. We shouldn't think about one part of man that is image and another part of man that is likeness. But Adam reproduces according to his own kind, and what we see then is that the son that he creates is made in his likeness. Now what is happening in Genesis 5 is that there's a deliberate attempt to show us that God makes man in his image and in his likeness. And man passes that image off. Adam, in one sense, is the son of God. And Adam passes that image off to his children, to his offspring. So what's happening then, I think, is that the image of God is what is being reproduced when man procreates. So we are not to think about them reproducing according to their kind, which in one sense would be true because their kind is image of God. But we're supposed to think about when they procreate, when they multiply and fill the earth, what are they making? They're making more of God's imagers. They're making more people in the image and likeness of God. So when they look at the child that's been born to them, they should not think, "Whoa, he looks like me." In one sense, that's true. But in another sense, they're not like you. They are like God. Here is another child, another creator, another creation of God made in his image and likeness. So I think that's just simply an observation that we have from the text. By simply observing the fact that he doesn't say that they reproduce according to their kinds. They are different than the rest of creation. They reproduce. The children that they reproduce look like them, but ultimately we see them as children of God. These are image bearers. Or think about the incredible way in which this should cause us to view childbirth or childbearing or reproduction. You know, we obviously in our day and age, there's talks of, you know, being able to create children in laboratories. Okay? Being able to do it scientifically, following some sort of medical procedure where eggs are implanted with sperm, and we can grow these babies in a lab somewhere, right? We have this type of technology that's only going to become more and more popular. But think about the significance of bearing children. You're bearing a child made in the image of God. You're creating other human beings, bestowed with the dignity, the uniqueness, the responsibility, the privilege of being and of those who take dominion and rule over God's creation. This should help us to see the immense privilege and how incredible it is that God involves human beings in making more human beings that are made in His image. Now also think about the fact that God creates man, and the text tells us male and female. So this is unique. Again, we don't hear of any other creatures being made male and female in Genesis 1. Even though it's clear that if they are to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, that there has to be male and female. And yet, the passage tells us clearly that mankind is made male and female. There's kind of this uniqueness happening in the account of the creation of man. There's a word, man, that's made. Obviously, a singular entity. There's just a one thing being made, but that one thing consists of two other things. Right? Mankind is a singular entity, man or human beings, and yet there is a plurality that's there. There are a duality that's there. Mankind consists of both male and female, both created in the image of God. Not separate, distinct, and yet there is also a unity there, that they can actually be representative of the whole. So you can see how that word follows all the way through from 26 into 28, where God can speak about them in a singular sense, but then He can also speak about them in a plural sense. So God is creating man. Man is a unity, but they're also divided, but yet they come together in a unity again to form and create more human beings. It's a beautiful picture then of the uniqueness of mankind. We see also just this repetition. Okay, the word create in Genesis 1 is used sparingly. He basically uses it in the first verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He uses it on day 5 when He talks about God creating the sea creatures, which is basically His way of saying that those ferocious, terrible, terrifying beasts in the ocean that you're afraid of, the behemoths and those types of things, those things God created too. The things that all the nations feared, God made them. He created them uniquely. They are His creatures. He uses that word once then on day 5, and then here in the creation account, He kind of bursts forth just this torrent of declaration saying that God created man. So 27 stands out to us. 27 is a break from the pattern, and it's repetitious. God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them. This threefold repetition helps us to see that the creation of man is unique. He's saying God created man, and He's repeating Himself throughout that text. So, for those reasons we can see, not only does God have a plan, a pattern to follow, a purpose for mankind, but it stands out from the rest of God's creatures. So what does it mean for man to be made in the image of God, or to be made after the likeness of God? What is the Imago Dei? Now, nowhere, people observe this, nowhere does the text actually define what it means for them to be made in the image of God. So whatever it is that we land on and how we decide that, we have to make sure that the text actually supports it. But it's not going to do it in a clear kind of type of way. So it's more inferred than it is actually explicitly stated. We can assume that whatever it is, whatever it must mean, sets man apart from the rest of God's creation, from the rest of God's creatures. So mankind being made in the image of God, after the likeness of God, makes man different from the rest of his creatures, from the rest of his creation. So we see how he's caused this passage to kind of jump out at us and to make this clear. But this part makes it really clear. Nowhere else does he say that a part of his creation is made in the image of God. Now, broadly speaking, we can kind of summarize how Christians have understood this in the past. They've understood the image and likeness of God in several different ways. Some have understood the image of God as a reference to unique attributes possessed by mankind. So this would be, this is defined in a variety of different ways, but we could say something like this, that man is like God, or he's created in the image of God because he can think rationally. He can use reason. He can think logically in orders and in patterns. He can think abstractly. He has the ability of self-reflection. He possesses self-awareness. He knows who he is apart from his being. It's not merely simply a matter of just kind of following something that's been written into his code, but he thinks differently than the rest of God's creation. So some have kind of viewed rationality or reason or logic as a way in which man is different than God's creation, the rest of God's creation, that he possesses this unique attribute as being because he's made in the image of God. Now some say that one of these attributes could just be a moral consciousness. So we are moral beings, different than other creatures. Like we are not only, we possess an awareness of what is right and wrong, we have a conscience, we know when those principles of right or wrong have been violated or broken. We know that when we do those types of things, we are accountable to someone for that. We are accountable to God. So some see the image of God being a moral capacity or a moral awareness. Some also see that one of these attributes could be moral capabilities. We possess abilities to live righteously or justly or in purity or to love others. We possess an ability that God's creatures, other creatures, don't necessarily possess. So some kind of see the image of God being one or all or some combination of those types of attributes. That mankind is different, made in the image of God, because God is a being like that. God is like that, therefore man is like that in that sense. Now, some also have said, they've taken a different view of the image of God and said that being made in the image of God is about what you do. It's about a specific purpose that you have, a function that you fill, something that we do. So some would point to the responsibility that has been bestowed upon mankind in taking dominion or in being given dominion. They have dominion over the rest of God's creation. Therefore, being made in the image and likeness of God is to be a ruler like God. That's what it means to be in the image of God. God has given them this responsibility to have dominion and to rule. Therefore, they are made in his image. So the image of God then is a description of the purpose that mankind has over the rest of God's creation. It's something that we do that is like God himself. God, of course, is the ruler above the heavens over all of his creation. He has delegated that rule to his created realm to human beings who are made in his image. So we have both of those ideas. It's either kind of an attribute or an essence of mankind, or it's a function that mankind serves. But what happens then if we think about humans who don't actually follow through on that function or who don't possess that specific attribute? What if for some reason that your ability to reason or to use logic is actually debilitated or limited in some sense? Does that mean that there's a diminished aspect of the image of God in you because you don't have or possess the absolute ability to think rationally? Would that mean that man is no longer in the image of God? If a man, you know, if we take the responsibility to multiply or fill the earth, the procreative responsibility bestowed upon mankind, if we take that as the image of God, as their unique function or purpose, then what happens to those who lose the ability to procreate? Or to those who refuse to procreate? Does that mean that they're no longer made in the image of God? Or if the image is simply something merely functional, related to our ability to take dominion and to subdue, then how does that apply to someone who doesn't have the capacity to take dominion? How does that apply to an individual who is unborn, a person in the womb? Are they taking dominion? Are they serving the purpose for which God has made? Or someone who is in a coma? Is that person no longer made in the image of God because they're no longer taking dominion or having dominion? Now, I think that having that perspective, even though it's obvious that God has given mankind the unique responsibility to have dominion, it's obvious from the text that that's different from the rest of God's creation, that we shouldn't attach image bearing to that specific responsibility. Because of the consequences of saying then that if mankind does not take dominion like they're supposed to, then they're no longer made in the image of God. They lose that inherent dignity and all human beings have. So what we see happening then throughout the text is that even though we're thinking about mankind before the fall, the image is retained by mankind even after the fall. So we see that in Genesis 5, we see it in Genesis 9 after the flood. Image bearing, we see it in James chapter 3. Image bearing and likeness bearing is maintained by mankind even after the fall into sin. So what options then do we have? There's kind of a third option that takes some attributes from both of those characteristics, the personal characteristic attribute side of things, or the functional side of things, that helps us to see actually in the ancient context what image and likeness is like. We see this actually in one of the books that the men are reading in the leadership study, Kingdom Through Covenant. We see that Old Testament scholar Peter Gentry summarizes the meaning of image and likeness by looking at the background to these two terms in the ancient world. He says that the image of God would have communicated two main ideas in the ancient world, that of rulership and that of sonship. So he refers to how these terms are used in the ancient Egyptian context in reference to kings or rulers. He says this, the king is the image of God because he has a relationship to the deity as the son of God and a relationship to the world as a ruler for God. So let me unpack that a little bit. When you think about the parallel context in which we read, you know, reread ancient literature to like this type of text, in the ancient world, how these terms were used in the ancient world in the Egyptian context was what? That these terms were used as a reference to the king, who was an image of God, of the deity that they worshipped, and that the king served two purposes. He related to the deity as a son, and he related to the world as a ruler. So the two ideas then of sonship, that he is a unique child of the deity, and that he rules over the world over which the deity rules. So that's the ancient Egyptian context that uses the same terminology to describe what image and likeness means. What does it mean to be in the image of God? To Egyptian, that would mean that you are a king who is a son of God and a ruler. Now, interestingly, when you think about the word image, that's the word that gets picked up in the Ten Commandments as a prohibition against Israel in making an image of God. You're not to worship an image, which means what? You are not to make a statue of any of God's created creatures and to bow down and worship it. So an image, and in Israelite context, in the biblical context, means a statue. You know, of course, this is what the pagans would worship and bow down to, a statue, a representative of the deity. So all throughout the Old Testament, you can see examples of this taking place. And you can see it in other parallel literature too, outside of the Bible. So if a nation that worshiped a particular deity wanted to demonstrate that that deity rules over the land in which they dwell, what would they do? They would go out and they would take a statue of that deity and they would put it on the boundaries of their territory. And they would say, basically staking claim to the land, saying that this land belongs to our God. Here is the representative of our God. He is staking his claim to the land that he has made. So that's another way that we could see how the ancient world actually sheds light on the biblical text. Egyptians would have considered these images to be sons of God and rulers for God. The other pagan nations would see that they are representatives of God. Now think of how this helps us to understand why the psalmist talks about royalty in Psalm 8. So what does he do? He reflects upon man. Lord, I look out and I see your heavens and I think how astonishing and how amazing and how majestic you are, and yet you've made man. You know, the glory and the garbage of your universe. How is it that you are mindful of him, and how is it that you care for him? And yet, what does he say? How does he conclude? You've made him a little lower than the heavenly beings. You've crowned him with glory and honor. Who do you crown? You crown royalty. You crown kings. You've crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet. So when he reflects upon the account of creation in Genesis 1, he sees that man is created as royalty, as rulers. They are made in God's image, therefore they're crowned with glory and honor and given dominion over the rest of God's creation. So the psalmist reflects upon that in that context and says, what does mankind look like? Well, they look like sons of God, and they look like rulers, representatives for God. Now, the interesting thing here is how this fits, and it also overrules what the nations would say. So if the Egyptians would say, well, the king is made in the image of God, the Bible says what? Man is made in the image of God. So the Egyptians would only apply it to the king. Here he is. Here is the sole representative of our deity. Here is the Son, the only one crowned with glory and honor, the only one ruling over his creation. And what does God say? The Bible says, God has given that to all mankind. God has given that, bestowed upon all mankind, male and female, that unique dignity. We all are representatives, sons, daughters, in a relational sense to God, because we are created in his image after his likeness. So Genesis 1 takes what the Egyptians would only apply to one sole individual, now applies to all mankind. What does God do then at the climax of his creation? He takes his image bearers and he puts them in his land, and he stakes his claim to it. And he delegates to them the authority to have dominion. So God is putting, thinking about it in that weird pagan context, God is putting his statues in the land that he's made, as his representatives. Here we go. Here's our statues. We're going to put them there. They're going to rule. They're going to be my vice regent. They're going to rule alongside me, rule under me. That's the dignity that he's placed upon mankind. So we're going to reflect upon that in a few moments. Let's first finish with day seven. So God's work of creation ends with the creation of man in his image and likeness. But the account of creation doesn't actually conclude until the seventh day. Now you notice this brings us into chapter 2, which, you know, if you're going to put chapter divisions into the Bible, you messed up the first time you ever did it. Like, you should have actually begun chapter 2 at verse 4 of chapter 2, but, you know, we'll give them a break. So chapter 2 then concludes the creation account. This is not a separate account of creation. This is a conclusion to the creation account that began in Genesis 1:1. Day 7 describes the culmination of God's work of creation. The climax was the creation of man. Now the culmination, the intended outcome of his creative work has been attained. Now there is merely the enjoyment of the work that he has completed. So you notice that this day is unlike all the other days in a number of ways. We don't have time to get into all of it, but the patterns that we see happening in the other days, broken, shattered. Like, he's tossing them all out the window. He's not going to say, and God said, and he's not going to say, and it was good. And God, he's not going to say those things. He's not even going to say that there was evening and there was morning. So all of that stuff that you saw on day 1-6, he's saying, nope, we're not going to do that anymore. This is something different. This is unique. This day is different than the rest of those days. Now God is actually going to rest. God is going to be refreshed. God is going to enjoy what it is that He's made. Our focus is drawn to the completion of God's work. He finished what He started. The blessing and sanctifying of the seventh day and the rest that God enjoys. So here we are given a picture of a king who is completely satisfied with his work. All things have been made, and everything that has been made very good. Nothing is subpar. There is nothing that God must come back to later to finish. All of it is done. Nothing is good enough. Everything is very good. So when God creates, when He created the world, the heavens and the earth, and all the hosts of them, He created it, and it was very good. So good that He could rest, satisfied in His creation and the completion of His work. God is now enjoying His creation. You notice that everybody kind of points out the fact that it doesn't conclude with that there was evening and there was morning. The seventh day. It doesn't conclude in that way, meaning God has continued to rest from His work of creation. He continues to remain content, satisfied with His work of creation. There's no more need for Him to come back and fix anything. God rests continually from His work of creation. So, we're going to reflect upon this just for a moment. What should we take away from this? First, I think relating to the image of God, we should take away the fact that God has made man in His image, and that should give us an overwhelming sense of the dignity of human beings. We looked a little bit at this in January when we just reflected upon biblical sexuality and the right to life. When we think about ourselves, though, we want to have the picture in mind of us before the fall. I think what we tend to do, we tend to think about ourselves after the fall. And we see that the image is somehow marred. But that original creation of God, the picture of what we are supposed to be, the pinnacle of God's creative work, should be the first thing that comes to our mind. We are all created, each of us, for right relationship with God, right relationship to His creation. We are His sons, His daughters. his rulers. Now, this could obviously apply to a multitude of areas, to how we treat other human beings, how we honor the value of each person, the unborn, the old, the deformed, the debilitated, to those that are like us and to those who are very different from us. It applies to all of those different things. Just think about the social ills contaminating our society today. Everything could stem from the dignity of human beings. Whether that's pornography, whether that's abortion, whether that's euthanasia, whatever it might be, it stems from a failure to understand and to grasp the significance and the dignity of human beings. If we could somehow see and recover what the image of God means, the dignity that God has bestowed upon his creatures, mankind, then those things would be diminished. All human beings possess this dignity. I think we get that. I think we understand that. But there's a different side of it. Do you think of yourself as a king? As a ruler? Do you think of yourselves as royalty? Do you think of yourselves the way that the psalmist thought about man in Psalm 8? Almost astonished at the smallness of man, if you want to call it that, but then as equally astonished at the glory of man. Do you think of yourselves in the second half of that way? Do you think of yourselves as being crowned with glory and honor? Or are you beat down? Of course, the thinking about ourselves in that way can be distorted and abused, and we recognize that as well. But I don't think we think about it enough. God created you to rule in relationship to Him. And don't ever let anyone tell you that you were made for less. Don't ever let anyone tell you that what's wrong, that you are what's wrong with this world. Think about the ways in which we hear that today, that the world is simply overpopulated and we need to take steps to depopulate it. We can celebrate that the replacement rates of births are not enough to maintain our current population, and we can see that human beings are the ones creating all the problems. But that's not what Scripture says. It doesn't say that mankind was the problem that God happened, the mistake that God made on day six. No, mankind is the crown, the head, the glory of His creative works. That's the dignity that we have as human beings. So we must think first and foremost of our dignity possessed by all human beings. Second, we must remember our destiny. We must remember our destiny as those made in the image of God. The creation account describes man as made in the image and made after the likeness of God. These words are important. They stress the similarities and the correspondences between God and man, but they avoid identifying man outright as the image. But when we get to the New Testament, we see that Christ is clearly described as the image. He's not made after the likeness of God. He is the likeness of God. He is the exact imprint of His nature. He is the image of the invisible God. Christ is our hope of glory, the image of God. Christ is the image of God in a way that we are not. He images God perfectly as His one and only Son and as the ruler of the world, that all authority has been given to Him and He rules over all things. So when we get to Hebrews 2, we see what? We see the author of Hebrews say, the psalmist was reflecting upon mankind in Genesis 1, and yet he sees Psalm 8 say, that's about Jesus. Here is the one crowned with glory and honor. Here is the one crowned with glory and honor because of what? Because of the suffering and His death that He endured. Here is the one who rules over all things, and yet we don't yet see all things underneath His feet. This is the one that we are being remade into the image of. So Jesus is the perfect image of God. And we are being renewed into His image. God says that the image of God is being renewed in us as we change and become more like Him. and that God has destined us to be conformed to the image of His Son, in order that He might be the firstborn among many brothers. God is creating a new family in Christ, and they're all going to resemble the firstborn. They're all going to look like Him. So yes, Seth was made like Adam, looked like him, made in His likeness, but now the last Adam has come, and God's creating a new family, and they're all going to bear the image of the Son of God. This is our destiny. Our destiny is to be made like Jesus in His resurrected and glorified state. Paul says this, "Just as we have borne the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven." That is our destiny. We possess that dignity, and what God is doing is to make us like Jesus. Now third, let us consider the rest that God points us to in Genesis chapter 2. He rests from His work of creation. And of course, this gets picked up, obviously, in the Ten Commandments when God has given His people this day as a rest when they reflect back on creation. You are to rest on the seventh day in observance. You are to refrain from work because God rested on the seventh day. He sanctified it, blessed it, and made it holy, right? He set this day apart when He rested on it. He completed His work of creation. And so mankind, or at least Israelites under the law, are being given that commandment to rest. But you also see that the rest is tied to the land. So even though they rest on the seventh day in observance of the first days of creation, they're promised a rest when they enter into the promised land. They are going to find rest when they go into the land of Canaan. Of course, this gets picked up in the book of Joshua, and it gets picked up in the Psalm 95, and it gets picked up in the book of Hebrews. How is it that Israel finds rest? Why is it that God promises a rest to them after they're in the promised land? So do you want to know what Hebrews says about that? So you can read all of Hebrews 3 and 4 if you'd like. But listen to what Hebrews 4 says. Let us read a brief couple verses. It says this, "If Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So then there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works as God did from his." So all of these themes then get tied together and wrapped up, that we see that the rest that God enters is a rest that He has promised His people, that they also get to share and enjoy that. They also get to share in the rest that God had, His refreshment and His enjoyment of His creation, when He sat back and looked at all of it and said, "This is good. This is very good." He could enjoy that moment for all eternity. And He invites His people to come into that rest. And what does that mean? It means that you cease from your works. You cease from your works trying to please and earn and satisfy this God that seems to be so demanding. You rest from striving after obeying the law or obeying some other standard or some requirements to make you acceptable to Him. Now God promises you that rest. He offers that rest to you in Christ. As Christ extends it to His people, "Come to me, you who are weary, heavy laden, come to me and I will give you rest. I will take your burden. I will bear your load. I will take it from you upon myself, pay for your sins so that you can enjoy the rest that God has been enjoying ever since the seventh day of creation." Enter that rest. That's the promise and the expectation. You cease from your works as God rested from His. So that's the exhortation then, to remember the dignity of humanity, to remember the destiny of those who belong to Christ, and remember and enter into the rest from your works because Christ has entered it before you. Let's pray.